Hello, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zen. How are you today?
I just did what you did. I went on a totally unrelated tangent.
My God. How did that happen?
You're hanging out too long.
You can't get good help nowadays.
What are you saying I'm not good help?
Well, I mean, being unrelated and going off on different tangents.
We're going to be focused, I promise, for the next 53 minutes. On a Thursday morning, we talk science. If you've never tuned in before, Dr. Carl is with us. He has been for many, many years. And he answers questions that you have. So hit us, 1-300-055-36. You can also hit us up with your answers or comments. If you can't get through, I know the phone lines are busy, you can text us with answers or comments, 0439-757-555. Or you can tweet direct at Dr. Carl, DOCTORKARL is his Twitter handle.
Wasn't it amazing that that big rock hit Russia?
More information is needed about that. I didn't hear.
Well, about within 15 hours of the rock that came by and missed us, that came something 15 metres in diameter, came between us and the weather satellites and the communication satellites.
Mm-hmm.
That's really close. And it didn't hit us because space is big and the satellites are small. It didn't hit them. 15 hours after that, a 10,000-tonne, 17-metre rock landed in Russia about 100-and-something years after the Tunguska event and attacked about 3,000 buildings and 1,500 people. 1,500 people injured, one woman with a broken spine.
Did this happen this week?
In Russia on the 15th of February.
Why didn't I hear about this?
Because the news cycle is incredibly short nowadays, and if Jesus Christ were to come here and give the Sermon on the Mount, followed by Abraham Lincoln doing the Gettysburg Address, that would last for 15 minutes before we did a story about a horse being able to ride a surfboard. Getting back to the meteor event. And I've worked out why it happened in Russia. Firstly, Russia is huge. To go from Moscow down to the equator and down to the tip of Africa is shorter than the distance from Moscow all the way across to the other end of Siberia. Russia is huge. Secondly, they're gloomy and bad things happen to them.
Are you saying they deserved it, Dr. Carl?
No.
Have
you ever seen a Russian comedy?
No. But,
okay.
But right. I don't really see much Russian cinema in general.
Yeah, look, but in your typical Russian comedy, and it's not their fault, it's just that the climate is very cold and everybody tries to invade them and their own rulers hate them and all that sort of stuff, right? And so bad things tend to happen to them. I'm being very unfair here.
This is not scientific fact, by the way.
In a Russian comedy, in a typical Russian comedy, the heroine is dying of tuberculosis for the first three acts, and in the fourth act, things get better and she gets run over by a bus.
Well, you've just beat me in the tangent stakes.
And have you seen the Russian play Chekhov's The Seagull?
No.
Two acts. In the first act, everybody is with a person that they do not want to be with. They're not with a person they love and they're desperately unhappy. In the second act, they team up with a person that they truly love. They find out that it's not that good. In fact, they're more unhappy. And the hero, who doesn't get anybody, blows his brains out with a shotgun. That is a Russian comedy.
1-300-055-36 is the number. Save us,
from
please.
Tangents.
Tim's calling in from Dubbo. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Tim. No more tangent alerts. Sorry, Tim.
We got them all out. Are you there, Tim?
Yeah, doctors, how are you?
Very good, Dr.
Confused.
Tim. Thank you.
What's your question, Tim?
Hey, I work all around Australia, travel from town to town. And I always have to change the frequency to listen to Triple J. I was wondering why it can't be the same frequency Australia-wide.
Oh, what line of work are you in?
Geophysics surveys.
Right, so that's a good line of work to go into if you want to do a bit of travelling.
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
But on the other hand, if you want to have a family and stay in one place, it's not so good.
Yeah, that's right. Tell my girlfriend that.
Ah, well, Triple J started off originally as a single J before they invented radio where there was just one guy shouting in the backyard really loudly. I lied about that. Then it was Double J, which was AM and confined to only Sydney. Then in 1981, they went over to the FM band. The FM band had some advantages. The quality was higher, but the range was shorter.
Yeah.
And by the time they'd moved into FM, well, a bunch of other stations had jumped in on various frequencies which weren't available for them to take up. You have to leave a gap between one frequency and the next.
Mm, there's actual laws about the closeness of radio frequencies, isn't it? So you don't get sort of
interference.
And, yeah. So
right.
In 1991, Triple J went from being a Sydney-only station
91.
To a national station. And then it was just impossible for Triple J to find frequencies that were the same nationally. Does that answer your question,
right.
Tim?
But yeah, that does.
What about the 9994 for the post office box address? When they decided way back in the past to make box 9994 your capital city, I'm imagining the 9994 hadn't been used up.
Mustn't have been.
Or is it related to Bradman's batting average, which was 99.94?
Yes, because everybody at Triple J was cricket mad.
Back then,
still is.
In 1932.
Thanks for the call, Tim.
Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Let's head to Adelaide, where Sarah's on the line. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi, Dr. Zan. Hi, Dr. Carl.
Hello. What's your question?
I just want to say I listen to your podcast every morning before I ride to work.
Oh, you're my new best friend forever.
It makes my ride very enjoyable.
Ah, how far do you ride?
I've never actually measured it. I don't know.
But how long does it take you?
It takes you about 20 minutes on the way in, 30 minutes on the way up uphill.
Ah, see, it's good to build exercise into your daily routine.
You're very chatty today, Dr. Carl. What's your question, Sarah?
My question is, my dad is a twin and my uncle has a daughter, and I've had this disagreement with people that my cousin is effectively genetically my half-sister.
Hang on, you're talking to the wrong guy here, because for me to work out who in a family is my son, daughter, uncle or nephew, I have to draw a diagram, because I grew up as a single child, very unhappy because I was a wog and they picked on me because I was a riffo, and so therefore I don't know how families run. So
because my dad and my uncle share the same genetic material because they're twins.
And your name is Sarah, you're a female, so you're a circle, and you have a father who is a square because he's a male, and then he has an identical twin.
Yes.
Right, okay, right, so there's an identical twin.
And his identical twin has a daughter.
The identical twin has a daughter, which is a circle, yep.
So I'm wondering genetically whether that makes my cousin and I half sisters.
Because you share so much DNA.
Yes.
Mm.
Or the argument against it I've heard is that the genes have mutilated too much over the period of my dad's and my uncle's life. But I'm arguing that I am genetically her half-sister, but I wanted some confirmation.
Your father and his identical twin at birth, when the egg split, their DNA would have been 100% identical. It would have shifted a little bit through replications, mutations in the uterus, but even now they'd still be 99% identical.
Okay.
99.9% identical. That's a hard one. Where is a geneticist to tell us the true answer?
Maybe they can give us a
call. We're asking for an entomologist.
1-300-055-36. 1-300-055-36 if you are a geneticist. Maybe you can get through to us on the text line as well, 0439-757-555. Hey, Sarah, we'll see if we can track down an answer for you before the hour's out. Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much.
Oh, whenever I'm about to read out a text, someone sends a new one and it kicks it off. Here we go. I'm a genetic counsellor, and yes, they are genetically half-sisters as their fathers have the same DNA. That was in response to, I think, Sarah, who was asking kind of confusing question just before that song.
So the question was, her father has an identical twin, and so both the men have daughters. And the question is, are they
half-sisters?
Half-sisters, and the answer is, from a genetic DNA point of view, the answer is yes.
Thank you to everyone texting in with answers.
And here's a tradie tweet saying, Science Hour with Dr. Carl is always the quietest hour on the construction site. Thank you. Any scientific evidence for amber reducing soothing effects of painful teething? No. In fact, it presents a choking hazard around the neck, and if they break the necklace inside their mouth, avoid the amber as a con.
I've been seeing lots of amber around children's necks.
Yeah, if it looks pretty, that's okay, but you know, it doesn't do anything for teething.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with pretty, though.
Let's get back into science talk back. We've got Bryce on the line. Hello, Bryce. Are you hands free? I've got a bit of an echo coming in.
That's all good. How are you going?
Hi, yeah. Bryce. What's your question?
Dr. Bryce?
Might be a similar question, but I'm a builder and I've been cutting steel yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I was cutting with a grinding disc. With a 20 mil diameter bar, it became magnetic, but the thinner ones didn't.
Wow. So 20 millimeter diameter, so the thickness of your thumb, when you cut that with a grinding wheel, an angle grinder, then the end of it became magnetic, but the smaller ones did not.
Yes, I'd put my tape on the end of the bar and it'd stick to it, but the smaller ones wouldn't.
Now, you do wear your hearing protection when you're cutting with the angle grinder, don't you, every single time, don't you, Bryce?
Of course. That doesn't take order.
Because as an experienced trader, you have a responsibility to the junior apprentices to show them the right way. Big it up for you. Straight answer, don't know. I would have said that somehow you'd set up some vibrations that had made the magnetic domains line up. So inside the steel, there are these tiny little domains, maybe a millimeter or so in diameter, and think of them as little tiny compasses, and this one's pointing north that way, and they're all pointing north in different directions. And maybe when you magnetize something, when you stroke it with a magnet, you line up the magnetic domains. They twist around, the magnetic fields twist around. And I would have said, oh, that's the answer, Bryce, and then you hit me with a killer. That the 20 millimeter one turned magnetic and the little ones did not. And suddenly, I don't know what's going on. Maybe there are different vibrations or resonances going on. We need to have the clever physicists tell us what's going on. And by the way, magnetic fields are, in general, due to unpaired electrons in the outer shells of atoms. But that doesn't give you your answer, Bryce. I don't know.
No. We'll see. We'll see if Australia can help you out. Keep listening, Bryce. We'll hopefully get to the bottom of it for you. Thanks for the call, mate. See you later. Maddie's calling in from West Brunswick. Hey, Maddie.
Hey, how you going?
Great. What's your question?
My question is, which is the most similar animal milk to breast milk? And I've got a couple of multiple choice runs. We've got a wager going.
A wager
for a six pack. So my friend reckons it's pig. The options are pig, cat, dog, horse, goat. That should do.
Okay,
cat
in general,
milk.
Human milk is thinner than cow's milk and it's sweeter. It's lower in, I'm getting this off a good friend Wikipedia here, it's lower in iron, retinol, vitamin E, vitamin C, vitamin D, unsaturated fats or essential fatty acids, but higher has too much protein, sodium, potassium, phosphorus and chloride. I do not know which milk is the closest to human milk.
Okay.
With regard to cow's milk, what happened was that about 7,000 years ago, we humans had had agriculture going for a couple of thousand years. We already had a history of raising cattle and travelling around with them. And a mutation happened in Middle Europe around Poland, Ukraine, that allowed people as adults to digest milk. So to digest the lactose in milk, you need an enzyme called lactase.
Yes.
And normally you have it as babies, but you lose it as adults. And some people, depending on where they come from in the world, don't have it as adults. This mutation arose then. And so we took up that way you got extra use out of your cattle. You could kill them and eat them, but before that, females ones, you could drink the milk. I do not know which milk is closest, but it depends on how frequently it nurses, because the more frequently you nurse, the milk becomes thinner.
Yeah. The answers, as far as I can see, I got led astray on Wikipedia and Google, but the answer is ass's milk.
Ass's is in donkey?
Yes.
Okay. It is the closest
half horse.
Okay, for which constituents, the fats, the proteins?
It's readily absorbable, as in easily uptaken and, you know, will keep you alive.
Hey, Maddie, why did you call us with the question if you know the answer?
There's a wager riding on this, and someone doesn't believe me.
Oh, so you want Dr. Carter to confirm
but I don't necessarily know. That's the only one site.
No, that's not enough. What you'd have to do is go to Google Scholar, and then you'd find in the journals of obstetrics and gynecology with regard to bring up babies, you would find there somewhere a comparison of animal and human milk. And that will be your answer, because all they say is more readily absorbed. I want numbers on proteins and vitamins. That'll give you
that six pack is going to have to wait a little while longer. Thanks for the call, Maddie.
Thank you, Maddie.
See you later. David's calling in from Leeton this morning with a question about farts. Hello, David.
Hi, Dr. David. Thank you for bringing farts in. We need at least one question every show.
It's been a while. Hello, David. What's your question?
Yeah, my question for Dr. Carl is, what's going on when someone drops their guts or farts or whatever? Like, what would you see? It just seems to stink out the whole room then disappear.
Thank you for using the term drop your guts.
Okay.
Suppose
you were to have a sheet of paper near the anus or rectum, you would have the initial blast zone or IBZ as we scientists call it, followed by surrounded by the splatter zone or the SZ. Then those little particles, fecal particles, would drop out over about 30 or 40 centimetres, and then the gas would then spread through the room. The gas spreads at a rate inversely proportional to the square root of the molecular weight and the wind currents. The reason that farts smell so strongly in showers, I don't know, but I think it's because the wind currents are carrying them around and spreading them around. On the other hand, in a closed space like a car, when somebody drops their guts, slash has a fart, it seems to spread awfully rapidly. What would you see? You'd see an expanding cloud of goodness, filth, gas. I'm trying to think of a non-moral word here. Waste gas coming out with interesting names like putrescine and so forth. And by the way, putrescine, which is found in farts and in dead animals, is also an essential component of coffee.
All right. Well, when you're in a room with the windows closed, like the smell seems to go away after a while.
I think, in that case, it is being adsorbed. A and D for Delta, not B for Bravo, not absorbed, B for Bravo, but ad, which means being absorbed on the surface. So then all of the wall surfaces are picking up a tiny layer of fart gas, which if you go there and warm them up gently with the hand with friction, you can then smell and relive the experience again.
Hey, David, thanks so much for the call.
Thanks
for the fart question.
I'm sure the nation thanks you as well. Text 900, just simply text it in. There goes lunch.
And here's a very quick answer. With regard to the metal rods being magnetised, a very clever answer from Cameron Watt. The smaller metal rod would heat up more. And heat is the natural enemy of magnetism. Why don't I think of that? You're so clever. Thank you, Dr. Cameron.
Thank you to everyone who always offers up answers for us. We do appreciate it. More minds means more knowledge. Ben is calling in from Hawker in Canberra with a question. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Dr. Ben.
How are you guys?
Hello. What's your question?
My question is, when I spin a ball horizontally, so like that it's spinning to the right, say, it bounces, comes up spinning to the left. Why does it change rotation when it bounces?
There's something happening when it in, notice the two words something happening. That covers my lack of knowledge. There's something happening when the ball kisses the ground because there'll be friction generated and then there'll be, for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. We're not dealing with a solid ball like steel, but rather a rubber ball and flexible and backwards and forwards motions. I'm out of my depth on this one. The person who would know would be somebody like a real physicist like Professor Rod Cross at the University of Sydney or any basic physicist who knows their basic physics. They'd be able to give you the answer on that one.
I can't do it.
I'm not good enough. But that's a very clever point. So you say you spin the ball horizontally and you drop it on the ground and then when it comes up, it's going the other way.
Yep, and it doesn't do it if it, like if I spin it vertically, it just keeps spinning that way. But horizontally, it changes direction for some reason when it bounces.
What about the second and third and fourth bounces? Does it reverse with each follow?
Yeah, it keeps changing.
Wow. So what I should do is get a soccer ball and paint some dots on it so I can track it and then spin it and then drop it and then see it go clockwise, anti-clockwise, clockwise, anti-clockwise. Oh, wow. Hours of fun for the family.
Absolutely.
Thanks for the call, Ben.
Thank you.
No worries.
Sorry we couldn't help you out more. 1-300-055-536 is the number to call. If you've got any answers or comments, 0439-757-555, the text line, or you can tweet Dr. Carl Direct, DrKarl. A couple of people texting in about farts, of course, saying that they smell worse in the shower because the steam allows the nostrils to flow easier.
Oh, to flare out because when you are smelling a fart, you are smelling molecules of their exhaust gases are ending in your nose.
Oh, that's even better. We've made it kind of a tradition over the last few weeks for me to Instagram a picture of you and whatever shirt you're wearing because you do have quite the collection. You can check it out. I just tweeted it from Triple J Mornings or you can find me on Instagram. It's just Zan Rowe. You do look very cute in that picture.
Oh, thank you. And it goes nicely with the bright red trousers.
It does. Yeah, there you go. See, this shirt may be low-key, but there's a party downstairs.
Well, see, it's blue and red, nice colour. Onwards.
Let's head to some more questions from you. Luke is calling in from Newcastle. Hey, Luke.
Hi, Dr. Luke. Welcome to the show.
Hello. What's your question?
Just wondering if humans can see energy.
Go on. Tell me more.
I can see it particularly when I sit in a shady spot and I look out into like a clear blue sky. I can see little specks of light dancing around in front of me. And it's more so when I look into my peripheral vision that I can see it more clearly.
And what makes you think that that's energy as opposed to little flecks in front of your retina?
I'm not sure, but like, it's also when I see, like, when I look at people, I can look into my peripheral vision as well and sort of see, like, an aura around them, like, and, like, things that are alive, like plants and that sort of thing. It seems to be, like, they give more of a glistening when I'm looking at it at that perspective.
The experiment has been done where people said they could see auras around people extending outside the perimeter of their body. So the experiment was done where people would stand on stage behind a cardboard platform, behind a cardboard cutout, leaving enough room for the aura to extend. And okay. Then some of the cardboard cutouts had people behind them and some didn't. And then the people who said they could see the auras would say, I can see an aura, but there'd be nobody there. Or they'd say there's no aura and there would be somebody there. So in other words, it dropped down to chance. But you can definitely see flex. And I think it's a Purkinje effect again. That Purkinje, P-U-R-K-I-N-J-E, was a clever guy, a Hungarian, whole bunch of things, physiologist. And if you close your eyes and then aim your face at a part of the sky that has no sun and then just defocus, you'll see like little shuttles on a conveyor belt going chick, 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 chick. And what you're seeing are red blood cells. Now, in your eye, there's a chamber going from the front of the retina to the lens, which is called the posterior chamber, and you can have little bits of gloop in that. And then there's the anterior chamber, which is very small, but in a day you have a total of 130 mils of fluid going through it. And in my case, working as a car mechanic, I hit myself in the eye with some bentonite pliers when I was trying to do a spring on a 54 Chevy headlight. And ever since then, I've had a little floater in that eye. So you could have little tiny particles that are floating around. But the energy one is interesting. Try doing the experiment where you don't know if you're looking at a person, a living creature or not, and have people document it for you.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Thanks for the call, Luke.
Thank you, Dr. Luke.
See you later.
Bye.
Let's head to Warrnambool. Paul is on the phone. Good morning, Paul.
How's it going?
Hello. Sorry, are you there?
Paul?
We've got a bit of a dodgy phone line. Paul. I might come back and see if we can get him on a better line and we'll instead go to Fiona.
Fiona?
In Ballarat. Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning, doctors.
Hello.
How are you going?
Very well. What's your question?
Just like Luke, I wonder if I have a super sense. I have an ability to smell smells that sometimes other people don't smell or also that I'm just oversensitive to, you know, intense perfumes and body deodorants and, you know, really strong scents, and I have to leave the room. On occasions, you know, it feels like I'm swallowing the particles and I feel nauseous.
Wow.
And I was explaining to the producer I can be at a music festival and smell someone smoking weed in the next tent and yet no one else seems to be bothered by it.
I read a story in a medical magazine about a traffic cop on the run on the Hay Plains between Adelaide and Sydney, who whenever anybody would have be carrying some illegal marijuana across in their car, he'd go into a sneezing fit. And then he realised that that was setting off his sneezing when he busted them and then put it all back together again.
Mm.
Getting back to you, the average person can smell about 4,000 individual scents.
Okay.
But the trained person can go up to 10,000, and maybe you should think about going to Paris and becoming a perfume smeller.
Yes, or a sniffer dog, perhaps.
That would mean having your nose to the ground and chasing bad people and possibly being out
in
the day.
Not as fun as going to Paris.
In some of the Paris is great. In some of the flower shops there, the flowers are arranged not by colour or size, but by scent.
Yes, by wood notes.
Yeah, this would be so wonderful for you. The way you smell is high up in your nose where you've got the olfactory epithelium. It's a little yellowish patch, which in a human, the two of them in each nostril add up to 5 square centimetres.
Mm-hmm.
In a dog, 18.
Yeah.
And in a cat, 21. So we really should have blood cats rather than blood hounds, but you can't tell cats to do anything.
That's right.
And then there are cells up there called receptor cells that do the smelling, and then Bowman cells that make a layer of mucus. This mucus is rich in fats and various immunoglobulins and proteins and carbohydrates and enzymes. And you can't smell every chemical in your environment. It has to be have a molecular weight less than about 300 so they can vaporize, travel through the air and then stimulate. And every living creature from a bacterium up has a sense of smell. It's not that the zoobacteria have a big nose stuck to them, but they can sense something that is good to eat or noxious and they should get away from.
Okay.
Mate, you sound like you'd be the right sort of person to be a perfume smeller in Paris, and you could learn to speak French and everything.
You could learn to speak Parisian.
Paris
although
the strong
perfumes make me feel physically ill, like I want to vomit.
Oh, God.
Oh, but then you could make a new line for people such as yourself. We're giving free trade advice here.
Do you enjoy certain smells? Or
I do. That's the ironic part of it. And yet when there is an intense smell and I can't stand it, I've conducted an experiment by putting some garlic cloves up my nostrils, and all that did was result in burning off the cilia, the hairs in my nose.
Oh, no.
Now, talk about the cilia. So you've got a smell molecule that comes and it lands on that mucus layer and it then stimulates the 10 million or so receptor cells. It doesn't actually land on the main body but on the cilia, and there are about 8 to 20 cilia per receptor cell, and each cilia is between 30 and 200 microns long, and they're nerve cells, and in general, when a nerve cell dies, it's dead forever. Well, that's before we learned about stem cells. The smelling olfactory receptor nerve cells are special, and they divide and regenerate themselves every 40 days.
Mm. And yet old people, they lose their olfactory skills as they age in their 60s, don't they?
They can, but if you don't train it. And finally, with regard to psychopathic people, they have the same threshold for sensing that a smell is in the environment, but they can't distinguish between leather, chocolate, orange.
A few people on the text line and Twitter are saying, Fiona, that it's worth seeing a GP because heightened sense of smell can often be related to brain issues.
Yes, I have actually been down that path and I'm all clear.
Great.
Yes.
That is good. There's some concerned people on the text line, so that's awesome to hear.
See you in Paris.
Hey, Fiona, one more text that we got from Super Sense Brad, who just wrote, "You are a wolf like me." So there you go. Thanks so much for that, Fiona. Cheers for the call.
Thanks so much, doctors.
See you later. Let's head to Geelong. Chris is on the phone. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, doctors. How are you going?
Great. What's your question?
Look, I read an article on a couple of weeks ago, and I know you don't believe everything you read, but the article said that there's been studies done that learning in some people had released dopamine, which had given them almost like an addiction to education or an addiction to learning. And I suppose the first question was if Dr. Carl had heard anything like that, and the second question was if that's the case, can it be taught, or can it be sort of taught to almost like children at school?
Yes and no, but it's more complicated than that. And secondly, it's only a small part of reality. So with regard to dopamine, yes, dopamine is released by the human brain, but only half of it. The other half of the dopamine that's released in the human body is made by the nerve cells in the gut. And if you talk about serotonin, which is involved with depression, only 5% of the serotonin in your body is made by the nerve cells in your brain. 95% are made by the nerve cells in your gut. So it gets more complicated than just, say, looking at a single one of the several hundred neurotransmitters we know about and saying, oh, well, learning is directly related to that and to nothing else. So it's a small part of the truth. It's a small part of the whole puzzle. But with regard to learning, I think you just find what you love. And yeah. Sometimes people don't find it. I got a friend of mine, one of my teachers at the kids' hospital, his daughter did a university degree and did really badly. Then she did another university degree and did really badly. Finally, had some kids, did a third university degree, got the university medal. Sometimes it takes time to find what you love.
Yep.
Hey, thanks for the call, Chris. Hey, Patrick.
Hi there, Dr. Van. How are you going?
Hello. What's your question?
Last year I was up at Litchfield National Park up in the Northern Territory. It's a beautiful place. But there are magnetic termites that can build their nest to face exactly to magnetic north. They face sort of down the line of magnetic north to south. And I was wondering if Dr. Carl or yourself might know how they do this, what mechanism inside them has this amazing natural compass to know exactly where magnetic north is.
Ah, well, I remember last time I was in Litchfield National Park, we all got scared by this enormous goanna, which was the size of a medium crocodile.
Was it a Parenti?
It was huge. I don't know what it was. And we were so scared of it. Because one of my friends thought that the best thing you could do with the goanna, and this is only a small goanna, the one the diameter of your thigh rather than the diameter of your body, what you should do with the goanna is just stand still, and it ran up her body with its big claws going, stab, 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 through her ribs and collapsed the lung and everything.
Oh, my God.
Getting back to your...
termites.
Termites.
Yeah.
There are many creatures that have magnetic particles in them. And the person yep. who has written many articles on this is a guy called Seth Putterman, P-U-T-T-E-R-M-A-N, who's at Caltech. And the fact that it's Caltech doesn't hide the fact that it's got several Nobel Prize winners there. It's a really good place. Pigeons have it. We humans have got it. I do not know whether the termites, which are not ants, whether the termites have magnetic particles in them or not. When you look at one of these termite mounds, it's sort of wobbly. You can't say it goes exactly north-south or exactly magnetic north because they're not a slab. They've got a straight size. It's sort of bendy. And my understanding yeah. was, according to the insect guys, was that they built them in such a way as to avoid the maximum sunlight, which happens coming from the north. So they're roughly lined up north-south, and they've got a slab on the east and a slab on the west, which picks up the morning sun or the afternoon sun, which is not as bad as the direct midday sun. And inside, they've got air conditioning. They've got special bedrooms for the babies, nurseries where they grow food, warrior ants who come out and attack you, all sorts of, warrior termites, they're not ants, and all sorts of other creatures. Do they have a magnetic sense? I don't know. Are they lined up with a magnetic, if you did an average of a whole bunch of termite mounds, are they lined up with the magnetic rather than the geographic north-south? Don't know. Maybe somebody can help us with that.
I hear that's why they're called magnetic termites, is that they line up rather pretty well roughly with that magnetic north, and that's where they got their name, is what I remembered from my trip up there.
That's what is said, but I was getting a lift home. I was driving home on the bus last week, and I was talking to some people, and I suddenly realised there's a whole generation of people whose entire knowledge comes not from hard knowledge, but from gossip. I heard, somebody told me, so I heard it somewhere.
Darren on Twitter just tweeted in at us, "Hey doctors, metal is in the soil / dirt, not in the termites." Make sense?
Mm-mm. No? Metal, magnetic, termite. Oh, maybe.
We're figuring it out. We'll see if we can find out for you, Patrick. Thanks for the call. Sorry, we couldn't
Google
help
Scholar
you out.
Will give us the answer as to whether they're done with magnetic or geographical precision.
All right, let's head to...
Much,
cheers, Patrick. Let's head to Katoomba where Justin is on the phone. Hello, Justin.
Hey, doctors. How you doing?
Great. Good. What's your question?
Okay, I travel a lot for work. I've done so for the last 6 years or so. And the majority of it's in, like, London and Paris and places like that, where it's a different time zone completely. You know, during their day, it's our night. During our day, it's their night. Now, when I return to Australia, I always try to book a flight for, you know, landing in the morning, so I push myself until that night where I'm exhausted and then my body clock's, you know, completely fresh. However, I have this argument with people in the UK time and time again that jet lag is a condition and that no matter how tired you are, you will just wake up. If your body clock is set for a certain time zone, you will just wake up and there's just nothing you can do about it. However, my argument is when you're exhausted and your body doesn't really care what time it is, it will sleep. I guess my question is jet lag a condition? Is it actually something that medically has been proven that, yes, you can suffer from jet lag for a certain amount of time or, yeah.
Oh, there are many rhythms in the body. And the classic case with jet lag is not the being tired, but having gone to bed exhausted, you wake up 3 hours later, wide awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, because that's sunrise where you were. And the rhythms in your body are such that, for example, you release a whole bunch of stress hormones at around 5 o'clock in the morning to make you ready for the stress of waking up. And you release testosterone and estrogen so you can love another person very much in a special way. And the early afternoon is the best time to pump iron. There are all these rhythms in the body. Jet lag is real. And with regard to the people on the International Space Station, the ISS, many of them take melatonin, so that they don't get upset by the constant 1.5 hour flickering of day into night, of day into night, and then try. Yes, jet lag is real. Melatonin, I am tempted to take it, but I never have because I don't know what the side effects are and I'm a wuss.
So what about, would you say that the rhythms in people's bodies are actually different to, like, is everybody obviously different? Because I don't suffer from it at all. I've never suffered from jet lag. I just seem to be able to reset my body clock, and I seem to be able to get a couple of hours kip on the plane, and then I land, and then, you know, the next day I'm right as rain.
Even flying somewhere like the UK or Europe, where you're completely on the opposite time clock?
Yeah, well, I got back from the UK a couple of days ago, and I slept on the plane. I got off about midday. I pushed myself until that night, and then I went to sleep about 9:30, and I got up at 7, and I feel fine.
Everyone's flipping the bird at you right now, Justin.
Well, especially in the UK, for sure. But, yeah, you know, my argument was, obviously, some people don't suffer from it. Obviously, some people can't sleep in a plane, so that's the reason why when they land at 9 o'clock at night, they can go to sleep straight away.
You sound like somebody who does sleep on the plane.
Oh, I can sleep anywhere. That doesn't bother me.
Stop rubbing it in, Justin.
Yes.
Well, if you're that tired, you'll sleep anywhere, like, you know.
Oh, no, but you can't sometimes. Sleep is used as political torture. That's the whole point of places like Guantanamo Bay. You don't want to leave any marks.
Justin, thanks. Right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you, and we're envious.
I knew you'd end with a tangent. I knew it.
Yes, I'm envious of him.
Someone just texted in, new name for Zan Rowe, Dr. Carl Wrangler. Yes, thank you for understanding.
Easier to wrangle cats than me, I'm sorry.
Dr. Carl, have we got time for one more really quick one? We've got about 40 seconds. It's a good one, though. Nathan's calling in from Newtown.
Nathan.
Hey, Nathan, hit us.
Hey, how you going, doctor?
Good. Yeah, make it a quick one.
I'll make it real quick. I've got a friend who is a little bit eccentric, and he likes to pick his nose and pick other people's nose and eat it.
Other people's? Other people's?
Yeah, other people's nose. Yeah. It's awful laugh. But my question is, what is a boogie made of? And is it harmful?
It's made up of various germs that have come in and mucus that has dried out and the dead bodies of immune cells from your body that have sacrificed themselves for the good of your body. And is it good to eat? I've asked both the gastroenterologist and the immunologist, and they each tell me to talk to the other people. I personally think that it improves your immune system. Got no proof of it.
Keep eating, Nathan's friend.
Other people.
All right, thanks, doctor.
Thanks for the call, mate. Oh, what a great way to finish. We talked farts, we talked snot, we talked everything in between. Where else but Science Hour?